I'm just playing with some Hurst blocks here and trying to come up with some ideas for stuff. So.
Oh, yeah? You know, you've got me really interested in those, by the way.
Cool.
In fact, Tracy and I were just talking about Orcus and talking about having minis and whatnot, and I was saying I'm pretty much done buying minis. I don't think I'll be buying any more for quite some time. But and I can't justify the $70 or $80 or whatever it is for Orcus. But I could move now into buying a bunch of Hurst Arts molds and generating terrain. Because I'm a huge fan of dungeon tiles. I have at least two of every set, and it's a really bad. But 3D stuff really entices me, so, you know.
Yeah, that got hooked on that. I mean, I love Dwarven Forge's stuff, but it's priced way out of my league, so...
Yeah.
And I don't have enough close friends and relatives that dig the hobby like I do that they would be willing to buy that kind of stuff for me for Christmas, so...
I can imagine.
So, and I love their stuff, but... It, you know, like I said, it's priced out of my range, so a good alternative is the Hurst Arts, so.
Yeah. Now, how long does it, I think I asked you this on Twitter a few days ago, but how long does it take you from prepping the mold to actual, a finished piece?
When you say finished, you mean cast and set up and ready to paint and glue, or do you mean including that portion of it?
Before the paint and glue, because that's a whole different ball of wax, I think.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, I would consider that finishing, but yeah. It takes about 5 minutes to mix stuff up. It takes another 5 to pour and scrape. I usually let my mold sit then for about a half hour. Mm-hmm. And that varies widely with the material you use. If you use regular plaster of Paris, 20 minutes, you're ready to go. But if you're using some of the dental type stones or whatever, then it can take a little bit longer. And like I said, mine are ready to usually to demold in 30 to 40 minutes, depending on how humid it is. That's the other thing, is weather conditions can, if you're not in a climate controlled area, you know, air conditioning, central heat, central air, whatever, it can. Right. It can vary. I know a lot of people that won't cast in their basements because of the humidity. So, I've got Thad calling me.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, you want to invite him to this?
Yeah, let me invite him in. Why don't you text him that I'm going to call him? I don't show him as online, but I will invite him. He's not answering.
Yeah, he's calling me now.
Tell him to quit calling. Uh-oh. Is everybody there?
Yep, I'm here. Still hear you.
Okay. You want me to call him, or?
No, I got him. I'm calling him up.
Yeah, I sent him a message.
It's ringing. Oh, there we go. Hello?
Hey, what's going on, guys?
Hey, Dad. How you doing, man?
Not bad.
So, but anyway, to finish my thought, after about 40 minutes, then you can decat or demold, and then I usually let them set up for at least 24 hours before I do anything else. Now, that time period can be speeded up if you've got a food dehydrator, which works really good for drying blocks.
Right,
so,
right.
And it's something I'm trying to acquire still, but I haven't got a hold of one yet. And it's the electric ones that I like. The one's got a little fan at the bottom of it.
Mm-hmm.
So...
So do you decide, oh... On Saturday the 5th, I'm going to sit in my garage for 4 hours and make 10 or 20 molds.
Yeah.
Or do you just, like, do a little bit at a time?
Well, right now I've got this stuff set out on my dining room table, so I can't cast them. I can't cast in my garage because it gets too hot here in the summertime. So.
And where are you again? In Kansas?
Yeah, Topeka. So.
Interesting.
Yeah. But I can cast indoors in, you know, heat and, you know, regardless of whether it's winter, I can cast pretty much any time. I can... I've got how many? Let's see, I'm counting my molds here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I've got 11 molds right now. So, and I don't cast them all the time. I've got an Egyptian mold that I've got some casts on, but I don't have done a lot. So, I like this Egyptian mold I've got though. I like because it will do sarcophagus with little mummies. And the mummy fits inside the sarcophagus and there's a lid.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That's cool.
I will try to, let's see, I don't know if I've got the camera around here or not. I don't know where it's at. But, yeah, you cast the actual little mummy and then there's a lid that fits on top of the sarcophagus. And like I said, it looks like a Egyptian mummy cask, so. But, yeah, Bruce has done some really, really good work. So.
Yeah.
But.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
I saw that someone had, what's the website again? Hirst Arts? H-I-R-S-T Arts?
Yeah, H-I-R-S-T and then Arts, yeah. And he's been around for over 10 years, so.
Now, I saw someone had tweeted earlier that there was someone that was selling terrain or something that's basically like Hirst Arts molds, but cast and painted and all that stuff.
Right. There's a few people that are out there doing that.
Dwarven Forge is probably the top one.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, Dwarven Forge is its own thing, though. I thought this other website was somebody who was actually using, like...
Just making the Hirst Arts stuff and selling it pre-done?
Yeah.
Basically, yeah. And he's allowed to do that because Bruce has a licensing agreement available that if you sign the licensing agreement, you agree to it. If you sell over $1,000, you owe him a certain cut, but under $1,000, he doesn't care, you know, a year or whatever. So this site, who knows how much they do. I mean, I've looked at it. Some of their finished stuff looks pretty good. I wish I was better at finishing than what I am, or I might try to make a run at them. I've got another idea in mind that I'd like to do involving them, but...
Hey, Sam, are you recording right now?
I am, yes.
Okay, good, because I can't figure out how to get this recording thing to work, so...
I'm recording.
Cool.
And I also, I Skype texted Game Fiend.
Yeah, he sent me a direct message and said that he was going to be a little late because he's doing some late night work right now, so... Okay.
Yeah, I just texted him and said, let us know if you want to be added to the conversation. So
yeah, he said he'll send us a message as soon as he's home, if he's got time.
Yeah, cool. That's fine.
I noticed newbie DMs online, but I haven't asked if he wanted to be in it yet.
Yeah, Tracy and I were talking to him earlier. He's busy packing and getting ready to leave, so he's probably not going to join us. He knows we're on here, so if he wants to, he can always pop back.
I hope Chatty didn't feel bad because I a few weeks ago someone had mentioned him in a Fellowship of the Tweet thing, and he had asked not to be included in those.
Oh, you know, no kidding.
To be mentioned. You know, I don't know if it had to do because he was doing stuff at work or what, or his tweet stream was being broadcast. I don't know what the whole reason behind it was.
Yeah.
But that's why I didn't include him when I was started mentioning it tonight, because it was like, you know, if you don't want to be mentioned in the chat stream, that's fine. Or the tweet stream. So.
I didn't realize that. He actually responded to me and said, he said, no worries, you know, count me out of the FOTT until further notice. I have to work on other things. So it didn't seem like he was upset or anything, but.
Okay, good.
Newbie DM kind of hinted at the beginning when we started this that a few people would probably drop out rather quickly, and I think he was talking about Chatty DM just because he has so many different things going on.
Yeah. Oh, that's fine. I just wanted to make sure the door was open to anybody who wanted to be involved, and so that's why I did that, but, you know, whatever.
So with the casting and the molding and stuff like that, I live in an apartment with basically no storage, and right. so I kind of been interested in that, but at the same time, I don't think that that would be, I mean, is it something that you can kind of clean up and store out of the way for a while, or?
Yeah, I mean, I live in a duplex, you know, like a townhome or whatever, and so I don't have a whole lot of room. I do have a basement and a garage, but, you know, with some I have a few shelving units, and all my stuff will stack pretty easily. It depends on how aggressive you are at your casting. I mean, if you go nuts, then, and you start building things, then your builds are going to start taking up space. And they're heavy, so you're not going to want to store them on cardboard. So, you know, those are the kind of issues that you have. Now, the stuff, if you build it right, will stack. You know, if you have some foresight into how you're building, if you're doing some basic, very basic dungeon tile stuff, all the walls are the same height and you don't have a lot of fancy accoutrement on top of it, then, you know, that stuff will stack.
Hey, don't start speaking all fancy and stuff.
Yes, I make no apologies for my sophisticated vocabulary. Yeah.
Well, they're known for getting all wordy out there in the Midwest, so.
That's right. But seriously, though, so you get, like, do you store them in, like, plastic containers, or?
Yeah, in fact, I have, you know, various, for the small pieces, I've got these parts bins. I've got two small, you know, metal and plastic shelf parts bins that are about a foot and a half high a piece, you know, like you would store nuts and bolts and screws in.
Right.
And then for bigger pieces, I've got like, you get them at Walmart kind of a thing. They're like a white, you know, shelf. I'm trying to, like a drawer unit that has, you know, maybe 2-inch high shelves. And, finished pieces I stack on a shelf, but the parts are in parts type containers. I've got some, canisters that I got from, actually I got them from the office because they were old lab canisters and, you know, with screw top lids and they're see through.
Mm-hmm.
So I store bulk parts, that I get, that I mold a bunch of in those. You hear it shake. Yeah. So the storage is pretty easy.
First fancy words and now sound effects.
That's right.
And what a way to show us up.
You're recording, so I thought I would make a good impression. See.
Speaking of sound effects, I don't know if you guys can hear all the noise I'm making on my end or if it's muffled enough.
No, you're doing okay.
Okay, good, because I am trying to open some pretty noisy packaging here for the whole reason I was late. So I had an hour to run down to my local game store and pick up my new Orcus figure.
Here it comes.
Well, you know, Orcus is the thing that started this whole conversation because Tracy and I were talking about whether – well, I asked her if she was going to get Orcus, and I was saying I'm pretty much done buying minis, and I can't really justify buying an $80 one at this point. But then I was telling – you know, I was telling Dead Orcs that – you know, but the 3D terrain now is catching my interest. So. how is Orcus? Is it pretty sweet?
He is looking pretty freaking sweet here. well, to be honest, I would not spend $70 on a mini, and I didn't. My girlfriend and I have, it's a long story. It's long and complicated. My girlfriend and I, we have these sticker charts, you see, like you would see in a kindergarten class or whatnot. And they're basically, we set goals for ourselves in working out and a few chores around the house. And you get a sticker for every day you work out and for every day that, you know, you do certain things. And when you make your goal, you get $20 at the end of the month. Like, I buy her something for $20. Sometimes it's flowers. Sometimes it's gift certificates to get her nails done. And so I built up a few months worth of goals, and then I was like, okay, I want Orcus.
To get what?
so that's the trick.
Yeah, my girlfriend bought it for me.
Oh. Well.
And he is hot, I'll tell you what.
Yeah?
Yeah, you guys can all come over and play with him anytime you want.
you don't realize how close to your house I am right now. I might just take you up on that.
Well, you're what? You're in Northern California?
Yeah, I'm about 40 miles from the Oregon border right now.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Looks like we lost Randall. Hold on.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Which is your first choice school again?
My first choice school is OHSU. Well, no. My first unrealistic choice is Columbia.
Okay.
My first realistic choice would be OHSU here in Oregon.
Right.
And Tufts is second.
Well, that's what you told me, so I'm going to write a letter to your first choice saying that they shouldn't take you. And then a letter to Tufts to say that they should, so that I can play with Orcus.
Oh, man. You know, my girlfriend right now is looking for a new psychology program because she's getting a PsyD, but she's looking at getting a PhD.
Right.
They're both doctorates, but one is practicing and one is research. And so she might switch to a PhD program, and I was trying to get her to look in the Boston area, to be honest.
Oh, yeah?
See, yeah. She did her undergrad at Tufts. And
oh,
so
okay.
It would be great if we could both end up back there. So.
I think it would be awesome. But, you know.
So Randall is, Randall's having a bit of a time getting back on, huh?
Oh, sorry about that. Okay. Wireless dropped.
There you go.
Damn.
Yeah.
See, you brought Orcus in, and all this stuff started happening.
Yeah, yep. See, that's what happens when you involve Orcus in your doings.
You let him out of the box, didn't you?
We were just talking about that. I just took him out of the box, so. I don't think I'm going to open his stat card, though. I think I'm going to leave it in the little plastic.
Well, who was it that was, someone was quoting his stats earlier today on Twitter, and it was like, holy cats.
Did they revise his stats from the Monster Manual 1 up to the Monster Manual 3 type for the stat?
I don't know. Let me run and grab. Or actually, I'll just look him up on Adventure Tools here, and I'll tell you. I know he's got a 35 strength, which is a plus 29 bonus, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. Don't arm wrestle this guy.
The first sort of useful for D&D app that I have on my Droid phone turns out to be the DDI compendium info pooler thing. I don't know actually what its technical name is. I'm totally jargonless at this point. But it's by some place called Syllogy, Syllogie. And I mean, I have a DDI subscription, so you have to have a DDI subscription. But you can search, and it'll pull up the stat blocks from the compendium right on
my
phone. So,
oh, that's
yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty nice. It's the only useful one that I've found so far for the Droid. You know that the iPhone apparently has a ton of there's dice rollers. For the Droid, but you know, a dice roller. I prefer to roll regular dice, so I don't really need the dice roller. But it's holy cow! I'm looking at Orcus's stat block
from the Monster Manual.
From the Monster Manual, yeah, I pulled it up on my phone. That's what got me to talk about it. So it's the only real useful application for 4th edition Dungeons and Dragons so far that I've seen, other than dice rollers. So it's nice. It pulls it right off DDI. It's really sweet. And when it comes up on your screen, it looks like a stat block.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's
kind of
cool.
I've used I4E a couple times on my iPhone.
Yeah.
Which it was actually written by a guy here in the city where I'm living in Portland. And I tried to connect with him a couple times, but we've missed both times. But it's a good program. You load your character into the program, and it reads probably about 80 to 90% of the character builder file. And then the rest of it, you kind of have to go in and type in by hand.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have connectivity to the compendium, which kind of blows.
Well, now, wait a minute, because I know I've used iPlay 4E online.
Right. The I4E and iPlay 4E, completely different.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
They are not connected in any way, other than the fact that they have very similar names.
So on the stat card with the Orcus mini, what's his hit points? Can you see the front through the plastic? I don't want you to open it if you don't want to open
it. Oh, yeah, I can see it. It's 1,252.
Yeah, see, it's got new stats because the Monster Manual stats are 1,525 HP.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they gave him probably more damage and then dropped his hit points in kind of the Monster Manual 3/2 style.
Yeah, this he has plus 37 versus AC to hit with his wand.
It's plus 38 here.
Yeah.
And
the damage is 2d12 plus 12.
Yeah, this is 3d12 plus 12.
Yeah,
plus
and this is plus
1d12 necrotic damage.
1d12 so. Necrotic and the target's weakened savings.
Yep. Good grief.
So they upped his hit by one, they added an extra d12, and then dropped his hit points a little bit. So
basically he does 3d12 plus 12 plus another d12 of necrotic, and you're weakened.
Right. Unless he hits you with his sweeping blow, and then he does 2d12 plus 12 plus 1d12, pushes you to, and then knocks you prone.
Oh, this doesn't have that. This has Touch of Death.
Got
tail,
that.
Tail Lash.
Got that.
And Necrotic Burst.
Yep, and then also, this one also has Sweeping Blow.
Sweet.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, this has
Master of Undeath, too. At the start of Orcus's turn, any creature killed by the Wand of Orcus that is still dead
becomes
rises as
a Dread Wraith.
Yeah,
yep.
That's awesome. Jeez.
See, I wouldn't even know where to begin DMing a creature like that. It would be like I'd need a team of people.
Well, you know what? You know what it is, though, is that you would be against players that are, you know, in the epic tier. So,
yeah,
you would have to utilize all of his powers probably to defeat them.
Yeah,
you know, but I have to pretty much utilize if I really want the creatures to challenge my players, because my players are they're pretty well versed tactically speaking, and if I want a creature to sort of challenge them at all, I have to like up the damage and make sure that I'm pulling out all the stops, you know, because they'll just totally decimate them if I don't.
You know, he's got a pretty nasty aura too. I don't know if it's the same in the Monster Manual, but it's a range 20 aura. Any enemy that enters or starts their turn within the aura takes 10 necrotic damage, 20 when he's bloodied.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's doing some pretty hefty damage.
Does it still have the other aura too, the Dead Rise?
Yeah, that's the Master of Undeath.
Yes.
Anything killed with the Wand of Orcus.
Right, but in the Compendium version...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's a Dead Rise. That's an aura 6.
Yeah.
Wow. Yep. Jeez. Yeah, this guy can do some... I mean, you are fighting... Like DM Samuel said, there, you are fighting a lot of guys who are, you know, in the 30th level. You get, you know, most people take Paragon or Epic Tier paths that, you know, when you die, the first time you die each day, you rise with full hit points and get all your powers back and stuff like that. So you're looking at characters who, even when Orcus kills them, they probably just pop right back up and go right back at him. So,
I have yet to play a campaign in the epic tier. I ran a one shot, but it was just really to sort of play with the mechanics and get people to use those types of powers, and so I could throw out some big bad, you know, like I used a Rimuraz and a Frost Titan and stuff like that. So, but it was just to look at sort of the mechanics of how the players would run their PCs and how the creatures would be run so far in advance of where we actually are in the real campaign. So I don't really have a lot of experience with the epic tier at this point.
I don't either.
You know,
all my is still heroic, so
I don't think a lot of people do. I think a lot of people have found for themselves that the heroic tier is their sweet spot. I mean, I think it was Chatty DM, or was it Dave the Game. Someone on Twitter the other day was talking about how they were just resetting their game back to heroic tier. because he just does not like DMing Paragon tier. And I know Joy of Geek and Geekzilla, their Band of Jenkins game just reset when it hit Paragon tier because their DM didn't want to deal with it either.
Yeah. See, so. Someone posted a link about, or posted a, did a blog post, and I, forgive me, I can't remember what it was, but they were talking about, oh, maybe it was Neo Grognard, was talking about the fact that, I think one of the reasons Paragon and Epic tiers aren't as attractive is because 4E hasn't changed the style of play.
Right, yeah,
for
I read
those,
that one too.
Or have, yeah, and it's like, we, there needs to be more emphasis on changing the way, not the mechanics, but changing the way that, and the things that the characters are involved in doing. The example they gave, and one of the biggest ones, is, for example, you know, in the older edition, especially first and second edition, you could build a stronghold.
Yeah.
At Paragon level.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. gather followers and things like that, and you could get involved in some intrigue, you know, nation building and stuff like that. And I think that, and of course the original D&D, introduced, you know, at least for epic play, you know, the idea of setting yourself upon an immortal path, which is what a lot of the epic,
yep.
pathways do.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yet they haven't emphasized them yet. And so there's no, I don't think there's a sense from DMs like, well, gee, my characters are Paragon level now. Are they just going to go hack and slash bigger and bigger monsters? That's going right. to get boring. Right. So,
you know,
anyway.
You know what I think the reason for that is, partially at least, is you're right. They haven't really, I mean, to be honest, for me, the Paragon path system that they have, the Paragon paths aren't, they're doing better on this with a couple of the latest sort of books that they've released, but the Paragon paths just weren't that interesting to me. And they still aren't that interesting to me. They're just not – they don't, like, change the game so much to make it sort of a new way to play the game and a new way to imagine your character. I mean, mechanically speaking, I mean, the fluff part is great, but they don't really add enough to it to make a Paragon path really something that – at least the way that my players talk about them when they're discussing what they're going to do in a couple levels. You know,
see, I
you know. Go ahead.
I, as a player, always get excited about Paragon tier, which is always sad because I really have yet to make it there for more than a couple games. But I've always felt like Paragon tier is where your characters finally get to open up. You know, you start to get powers that are, you know, they break the rules a lot, they start breaking the rules a lot more than just the, you know, you get to move a couple extra spaces or, you know, you get to knock somebody prone or something like that. And you start getting a lot of gear that's really fun. You know, high crit weapon – or, yeah, weapons that lower the crit range into, like, 19-20. The damage dice start piling up. And to me, it just seems like that is more fun than running around rolling the same dice using the same powers you have been for, like, the last years for me. You know, almost – almost a year and a half now playing in Heroic and never getting to step past that.
I think that if DMs can – and I think you're right, Thad. I think from a player's perspective, the Paragon paths I think are pretty neat. I know as – you know, I've only got one character right now that's in an active campaign but as a player. But, you know, I want to get to Paragon level. I want to see what some of that stuff does. But I want my DM to be stretching – what I'm doing. In other words, I'd better be going off world. I'd better be, you know, to different planes or whatever. I'd better be, right. either that or involved in some kind of, you know, nation building activities, you know, things that, you know, I expect the DM to help take care of those issues. And myself as a DM, those are the kind of things I'll be doing with my players just so that it doesn't become, you know, I think there's a tendency to want to, and I'm going to use the word World of Warcraft, you know, type grinding. And you can't do that with D&D. It doesn't. It's not the same kind of game. So you know, yeah.
It might just be that I don't have enough experience with it, you know, because I haven't designed the Paragon part of my campaign yet. So I have to figure out where the players are going to go first. So.
My campaign right now that I'm DMing is just they're about to hit level 3. Mm-hmm. And I am already planning out their Paragon tier. Epic, I don't even want to touch yet because, you know, I haven't even had anyone last long enough without wanting to start over to make it to Paragon, so I'm not even going to touch Epic. I'm not going to put that time, kind of time into it. But, you know, they're in Eberron right now, and I hope none of them listen to this because I could be giving a lot away here. But the basic of it right now is, you know, there's always the underpinnings of war brewing in Eberron, and you know, their heroic tier is going to get take them right up to the war breaking out, except I'm basically going to have Corvair be attacked by one of the other continents. You know, maybe Arganessen, maybe the dragons are going to attack, and all of Paragon tier is going to be them leading all of Corvair, all of the nations united against these dragons. So suddenly it's not this hack and slash around Corvair anymore. It's, okay, now you guys are representing this entire nation. You know, your job is to land on Corvair, build a stronghold, fight off dragons and dragonborn and dragonkin, and then eventually, you know, defeat dragons. And then after that, you know, that's when Epic tier starts, and God knows where I'm going to take it after that. But there's got to be some kind of grandiose change or some kind of alteration in the way you play. There has to be a different idea than, oh great, we've got another mission to run on, we got to go pick up another thing. Now it's just a bigger box we've got to go recover, or it's a bigger monster we've got to go slay, and a, you know, a hotter princess we've got to go rescue. It's got to change.
I have an idea of what my players are going to end up doing, and you know, they probably will listen to this. They're probably going to end up in the Underdark, like deep in the Underdark, and inadvertently step into the plane below, and have to do something there. But like I said, I don't have it planned out very much, so that might totally be scrapped. But I really love the Underdark and the plane below, so that's what I'm hoping to utilize.
What level are they at?
Right now they're 8.
Okay, because mine just got 9th, and yeah. I don't know what to do yet. And part of the problem is the math doesn't change as you get higher in tier. The powers get awesome, but the overall balance doesn't really shift yet. So I don't know what I'm going to do with them. Maybe they'll just take over Noomshire. That'll work.
Yeah. And see, I sort of want to go back to what Randall said earlier, was that, you know, I remember when you got up to the higher levels, you could build a stronghold and, you know, you would have to do, sometimes you would have a whole series of sessions that basically allowed you the ability to win over followers and get hirelings and get everything sort of set up for your quote unquote kingdom, you
right.
know. And that became a focus for a lot of mid level campaigns or higher level at that time campaigns. And that stuff just doesn't exist in 4th edition. Well, so you know, I don't know. I guess I'm sort of I'm trying to change my way of thinking into 4th edition higher levels, and I haven't done it yet.
I wonder if part of it is that they just left it up to the DMs a lot more, because they Logan in the Slaying Stone mentions that as a possibility for the town afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's something.
Go ahead.
Oh no! Keep going.
Oh, no, it's just that it's an option for something that they could do with the town if they decided to clear out what's in there. They could make it their stronghold or their base of operations or anything like that.
Yeah.
Well, someone once wrote a post on basically the the makeup of what a town would be in Dungeons & Dragons. And if that person could get on the ball and write a post on basically how to build, how the players could use that to build out their own little keep or their own little town, that would be awesome. I think it was a post on like the economy of a city or a town.
Oh, I remember that post. Right. Who wrote that post?
I don't know, some hack.
And for the listeners, do you want to introduce the hack to the listeners?
It's over here. I just looked it up. It's over here on Initia What, and that's Initiative What.
You know, I actually had beginning level communities in mind when I was designing that, but that works for building a town for any reason, actually. So, Yes.
But yeah, I could see that post or a similar post being very easily geared towards players. Like, players, here's your guide on you want to build your own keep. You know, these are the people you're going to have to hire. You need blacksmiths. You need bakers. You need these kind of guys. And this is the kind of money you're going to need to fund this. And so not only are they going to have to stay on some kind of mission, but they may have to decide for themselves, okay, we need to go do something. We need to go kill a dragon because this is getting expensive. And, you know, we're the ones giving out the missions these days, and we need some money in the coffers. And so you may have right. your players at Paragon tier taking the initiative to say, okay, DM, we know we need to save the world, but right now, you know, we're trying to keep this town running also, so let's go kill a dragon. You know, do we know of a dragon or any kind of mythical creature that's been terrorizing the neighborhood? Because we need its gold.
Yeah, and the gold's be more important than the XP at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the fun thing about using the internet and more tech-savvy players is that you could even do, like, your town building in Google Wave. You know, throughout the week, the DM could basically tell the people, you know, this is what happened in your town. It costs this much money. You guys have this much. You know, something fell down. A building started on fire. Do you want to repair it? Do you want to build it? It could basically be like sim D&D through the week, and then they could come to the game table and actually, you know, play their characters for a while, and then through the week on Google Wave, play sim D&D town.
You know,
my players were as enthusiastic during the week for my game than they are on game day. That would be awesome. I was going to raise a little warning flag for me when you said sort of like sim D&D, because I think for me, at least in my campaigns, I want to sit down with them. If a player had a specific desire, it's like, look, I want to build a stronghold, I want to build a tower, whatever, I would probably just dig out my good old third edition or second edition stronghold builder's guidebook and map it out and tell them how much it's going to cost. By mid-Paragon, they'll have plenty of gold, so that's usually not too much of an issue. And then it becomes just a foil for RP, I mean for role-playing. In other words, maybe there's an issue where the tower is in danger, but it basically becomes a safe haven for them to go to. I can set certain events around it that are role-playing nature, and it just becomes another a foil. So instead of the characters being nomadic all the time, they're in a set place, perhaps, but adventure starts coming to them, either by reputation or whatever, and that's where it goes with me. I mean, maybe some things will happen, but I try, once I've given something like that to my players, I don't want to really, for lack of a better word, jeopardize it an awful lot, because that gets old. It's like, you know, I don't want to give
them every month the orcs are attacking the village again, darn it. Yeah. You know what this is begging for? This is begging for a cooperative town building post. You know, I wrote a cooperative party building post a few weeks ago, and I might now have to write a little primer on how to have your players cooperatively build a town or stronghold. And then it would be like what Randall's suggesting. You know, you spend maybe one session sort of fleshing it out and figuring out, you know, what it is, and adding a little bit of history to the people that are going to populate your town and to the home base that you're creating, and why did you pick that place, and, you know, what's so great about it, and what are the disadvantages to having it, and then you just continue your game otherwise, and you only occasionally reference something happening at that place that, you know, or if they need to rest, they can go back there, and maybe it's not, there's nothing happening there, but you at least have that in place in the game. So, I don't know.
Let me interrupt your thought there for a minute. The reason I ask is that I have never had a problem with my DMs in even when I'm starting a brand new character to allow me to establish a place for my character to live as part of my background. Has that ever been an issue for any of you guys? Because, you know, I've got a sorcerer who lives in a cave. You know, I've got I had a ranger at one point that lived, kind of underneath the stump of a very, very large old but dead tree, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I was just wondering if it's sort of only sideways related to what we're talking about, but if even at first level, if having a base of operations was like out of the question, or do you assume that your players are just nomadic and living out of inns the whole time?
I've always had players who were, I don't know if it would be mercenary is the word I would use for them, but basically if they ever cleared some evil element, like a band of brigands or gnolls or goblins, out of anything that looked like a standing structure, even if it was just, right, you know, four wooden walls, they would claim that. You know, most of the players I've played with would claim that and just be like, you know what, this inn we just cleared out, this is ours now. And so,
okay,
almost always have I ended up with, you know, players having a home base, which is fun because I even, you know, I'll pull out a map of a of an inn or a tavern or something and let them even, you know, move their pieces around and RP in that and be like, here, here's your guys' little base. You got a little warm fire over here and some brandy and, you know, right, go to town. So
what about you, Tracy?
My players haven't set up a home base, but they've had to move around a fair bit. But I was in a game where I tried to set up one because it was a sandbox where people were coming and going every week, and that way we could put all the magic weapons there and people could share them. And the DM didn't really work with me on that one. There may have been other stuff going on, but I think he just didn't feel it was worth his time to work on it, which kind of was sad for me. But
see, not to take over the conversation too much, but yeah, you would almost think, just in reply to Tracy's, that to have a group where people are coming in and out all the time, it would be more beneficial to give your players kind of a home base. Just that, I think it was the DM Guys podcast that talked about kind of doing a Hall of Justice kind of thing. Just a home base where you can, okay, well, right, so-and-so went back to the base and, you know, he called in a substitute. And, you know, that's why Jim's here this week filling in for him. You know, you can always...
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Exactly. You know, one guy heads back to the fort while one guy comes out to take his place. And then you don't have to worry about, you know, people falling through plot holes and stuff like that.
Right.
That's true. I've always had it. It depends on the player. I mean, I've had several players who write it right into their background from level one. You know, here's where my character's from. This is something that some place that I can always go back to, unless it gets built into the story that something happens to that place. But that's a different story, right?
Right.
You know, this is their character's home base. But I'm more talking about, you know, once the players are sort of at, when they've gained a few levels together and they're sort of an accepted adventuring party, and they, you know, if they want to have a home base that's established as the adventuring company's home base kind of thing, it's a little bit different than, you know, just having a player that has a home. But, you know, it is really player specific to me. I've also had players that are like, well, you know, I built it into my background that they can't go home again because of some strife going on. And then that person really is just a nomad for a while.
So. And you're always going to find the player, and it's pretty frequently among players, of the, you know, the lone wolf, the tragic past that, you know, he's separated from family and friends and everything else, and so he's wandering the planet. But, you know, I think there's some, I think, I don't want to use the word realistic, but there's some who, you know, I think myself, I prefer a background that has some kind of grounding. It's like, why would he necessarily be wandering the planet? It's like he comes from the local area, you know? But
this is true. And it's funny because I'm so new to this whole RPG genre, you know, and D&D being my first game, and I just bought Dresden Files as my second game. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess Munchkins, if you count that, was my second. But with the Dresden Files, I just made my first character today, and he is like a guy who still lives at home with his parents. And
cool.
So, yeah, and so I'm seeing that, and exactly what you're talking about. Every player in my current party for Dungeons & Dragons, every one of them was alone, wandering the world. You know, one guy was looking for his lost master. One guy has amnesia and has no idea who he is, because, I mean, that's not classic. And, you know, one guy was just, you know, kind of a jack of all trades doing work for people and got hired out to the party. So it was like no one really has a past and no one really has a home to go to. And I think that's really, really classic in D&D, because people just why else would you be out in the wilderness with a giant sword killing direwolves?
Right.
Right. Well, what's their background with playing D&D? Are they all new to playing, or they played older editions?
One guy in the group had never really played D&D before.
Okay.
And his character is a shard mind. So his guy kind of has a reason for not really having a home. He's just been kind of newly born since it's a brand new class. And, you know, one guy was DMing another group, and he's been playing D&D for 5 or 6 or more years now. And so, and the third guy, I don't know how deep he goes, but most of them have a pretty solid base in Dungeons and Dragons.
Right. It's a theory I have that people maybe that are newer to the game are more likely to create the stories that are intertwined and tied to locations than the people who are older to the game, because if you played for a long time, almost everybody has always created their character off on their own. And the game didn't overly reward cooperation, where fourth edition, right, you really need, like, you don't need to, but, you know, if you're going to play a rogue, you really want somebody who can help get you combat advantage, whether that's by being the fighter that's up with you or somebody that has a power that grants it to you. So I think the cooperative building is more of a fourth edition thing, and it's harder for older players to get around because they're just so used to going off on their own and creating their characters.
I think you might
be
right.
You know what sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I agree with you. I think you're probably right, because I've noticed in DMing 4th edition now for 2-3 years that the parties that where the players all sit and they create their characters all at the same time with each other, and they, you know, you just it's human nature to have a tendency to say, oh, that's awesome, I'm going to pick that power. And then the person across the table says, oh, which one? And then you talk about it. And then another person goes, oh, hey, that would work great with my other power over here. And so you have this sort of cooperative character generation going on. And the players and the PCs end up working a lot better together that way than everyone sort of just coming to the table fresh for the first session, and they have their character and no one else really knows what's on everybody else's character sheets.
Well, that's
which is
why,
traditionally the way that it used to be done, right?
That's why 2 games in, you just do a TPK on purpose, and everybody has to build a character together that way.
Well, I was going to – yeah, and I kind of agree with both of you, is the fact that my large group, even back when we started in 3.0, I set them all down. It's like, look, this is the campaign setting, and, you know, these are your options from where you can start. And when we retooled for 4.0, I was like, look, you all need to be around from the same basic area. I don't care how you got here, but you need to tell me how you got here. And you've been here a little while, but you need to tell me how. And they all ended up creating backgrounds to one extent or the other that, you know, place where I use the default campaign setting to begin with. It's my world, but it's set in Fallcrest in that surrounding area. And, you know, and they all came from that area. So and their stories actually intertwined, to some effect. Cause I did that on purpose. I said, look, guys, I need you two and you two to come and you know each other. Tell me how. And so, and it was a bit of a force, but it was, it actually got my players talking to each other. And saying, oh, yeah, but this part of my story, I could know this. And, you know, from the past, we could have done this together and blah, blah, blah. And that worked really well for creating a fairly knit group. And it was – and we've all been friends for a long, long time. So that's not – we didn't have to get over that kind of awkwardness with it. But except for one – we had one guy that didn't really know us as well as everyone else did. But with that exception, it was – you know, it really helped bring everyone in the group together. So,
well, cool.
And I think
can I
think,
go ahead.
Oh no, keep going.
No, I was gonna actually change subjects a little bit. So if you want to add something to the last subject, then go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say that, you know, there's that benefit that you get when you're playing in a group of people that you know, when you have a friend base that you can bring together and play a game, whereas, you know, I had just moved to Portland when I first started playing role-playing games. And so every group I've had has been, you know, off, you know, I find them on the D&D, you know, the Wizards of the Coast D&D forums or meetup.com or, you know, just I have to go out there and find them. And so the first night we play, no one has really met each other besides maybe getting a drink in a bar or a coffee shop for the initial meetup. And so getting them to work together is really hard, which is kind of why I made that joke about, you know, two sessions in you do a TPK. But I usually run my first two sessions as not having anything to do with the campaign. Like, it's basically a delve, two delve nights. We go in, you guys play your characters. And then once they figure out whose characters can work together and how they work together, or, you know, and it worked well for the party I'm playing with now. The defender basically came back 2 days later and he's like, hey, I'm going to change a lot of my powers because he's not really doing what I wanted him to do. And the wizard was like, hey, you know, I thought I was going to be a summoner, but now I want to do this. And so the party really came together cohesively, but I didn't really put the focus on story. And I think I should do more like what Randall was saying, which is kind of just force their hand and be like, okay, now you guys have your characters together. Now you two, you know, pair off, go make some stories and come back.
Right.
There was a pretty good article called 52 Pickup by Rob Donahue, where you just have your players pick three cards from a deck and they have to make up the stories that go with those cards. So it could be something like, what did you steal from the person on your left? And help build the story that way. But it's a little...
Oh, cool.
It's a little scary for some people because it's totally random what you could get. But those sorts of things are cool because it could be you could have stolen anything. You could have stolen a shoe once.
Mm-hmm. What do you want? Where does Rob Donahue write?
I was going to say, do you want to give that blog address for the listeners at home?
I would love to read that.
I think it's Space to Think. It's rdonahue.blogspot.com, and I also referenced it in my article on temporary hit points.
Okay.
Yeah, it's called Some Space to Think. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
All right, I'm definitely looking that one up.
Awesome. So I was going to, I'll probably post this on RPG Musings, by the way, and I'll put links to everything in the show notes, or maybe I'll post it on, anyway, we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, I think it should go up on 3Geeks4E, but on a subsection.
Yeah, I was going to say we might do that, but we'll have to talk about that later. So once it's posted and everything, we'll have all the links and all that. But it's good to just say them out loud too.
Well, we could ask newbie DM if he wants to post it up on the Fellowship of the Tweet website.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, that's true too.
Kind of where this was born from. So.
And this is actually kind of a unique opportunity because everyone that's playing as a character in that campaign is also a DM.
Right. And not, so it's like not a just game. not just a DM, but a very outspoken community DM.
Right, yeah, yeah. Very outspoken. Are you calling me obnoxious?
You're reading into that one just a little too much there.
All right. Sure.
don't be my girlfriend, man. Don't go.
Yeah, I have my own girlfriend, so I won't. Yeah.
You're no angry DM, but
yeah, that's true. So I was going to actually change gears and ask you guys. So Thaddeus said earlier he's running his game in Eberron, and I think everybody knows I have my own homebrew world that I'm running in. And Randall, you said that it was your world, but it sort of began in the Fallcrest sort of generic setting.
It's my campaign setting, but it's I use a lot of prepared material.
Yeah. So the two questions are, what do you run your game in? Which I sort of just did, except I don't know what Tracy does. And then the second question is, are any of you thinking of switching to Dark Sun when it comes out? So Tracy, do you want to go so you can tell us about your game world first? We don't know what you're running in. So.
Mine's just pretty much a homebrew. I steal liberally from everything, including older modules. a lot of my towns are based off of third edition and sometimes second edition modules. And then I steal a lot of the items from Eberron because my husband's a huge fan of that setting. But that's pretty much it. I stay away from Forgotten Realms.
Oh yeah, why is there a particular reason for that?
I feel like it's
you know Jeff Greiner is turning and he's his eyes are gonna get really big and they
might... and Matt James is gonna hate me too, so I'm just screwed all right around. But
tread lightly.
It's because I've only been playing D&D for a year. Everybody in my group has been playing for a very long time, you know, at least 10 years. So I just can't compete with the knowledge that they have. So if I create it all, then they have no one-upmanship on me. And also, I'm not going to ruin their expectations. Like, we talked about this a little on Twitter with there's no gnomes in Dark Sun, and yeah. There was another one. And it was like...
That was with Chris Sims. No gnomes and no goblins.
No goblins. Yeah. And it was because there had been some genocides years before. And that's great, but that's not an obvious thing. And so I would be so afraid of putting them in. And then my player's like, well, what's so special about them that they exist? And then just having that moment at the table makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it makes me worried. And then I'll second guess myself for the rest of the night. And I know that's something I just have to work on, but I haven't worked on it yet, so.
Well, you know, the reason I stay away from Forgotten Realms, and now they're going to bug their eyes out at me too, but the reason I do that is because, sort of the same reason, I bought the very first boxed set Forgotten Realms for second edition, and I still have it somewhere, but that was the first one I bought, but I never got to play it or DM it in second edition. And I haven't read any of the novels. I know there's a large gasp coming from everyone, but I haven't read any of the novels. So I feel the
same
way.
You're not the only one.
As much as I love R.A. Salvatore, okay, I've read a lot of his stuff, but just no Forgotten Realm stuff. And if I do something that breaks the expectations of my players, I'm afraid that it will make them not have a good time. And it's not that I'm afraid of breaking the expectations, because I'm a big proponent of breaking the expectations, because sometimes you need to do something really out of the ordinary to get the player's attention. But I don't want to do that every time we have a session. And that's probably what would happen if I was playing with a group of players that really love Forgotten Realms, because I just don't have the knowledge for it.
Right, and it's the unknowingly breaking it that's the problem. Because because then they're going to feel like it's an important thing that this is being broken, and you're just like, no, I had no idea, I'm really sorry.
Right. Right.
I don't understand why you're doing these history roles, these religion roles, there's nothing for you to find out.
Right, right. Yeah.
See, and that was my issue with Forgotten Realms, too, is that I had DMs that would go in, and I loved the lore. I mean, it was such a rich world. I've met Ed Greenwood, and he's a totally weird cat, but but it's a great world.
Oh,
and I,
don't worry.
And
I'll do, I've,
and, I, yeah. And it's been, I mean, I've been in it since second edition. I mean, I had the gray boxed set of the Forgotten Realms, you know.
And
it's been around for a long time. And so as you're reading it and you get involved in the canon, the one thing that's really a problem, I think, for that is that you never get to really be the star in that campaign setting, because there's always going to be an Elminster or I'm trying to remember some of the other guys, a symbol or somebody like that that's going to steal the show later on down the line. In some plot development or whatever for the campaign, and if you try to work around that too much, you feel like you're breaking the campaign setting, and so right. You know, and I think that's why I didn't mean to start on a let's bog on the Forgotten Realms thing, but yeah, that's why I don't DM in it, because it's such a rich world and there's so much wealth of knowledge that you really got to have that it's more effort than it's worth. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no. You haven't answered all the questions yet. I'm going to wait my turn.
As far as Dark Sun goes, I mean, I play in my own campaign setting, but I use a lot of prepared materials. I use, right now, my characters are still, I mean, my players are still heroic, so they're running through modules. And, but I love Dark Sun, and I don't think I'll ever DM it. I'd play in it in a second, but I don't think I'll ever DM in it, only because it does have such a large number of special issues with it that it would break my own campaign setting, and I would have to send them to Dark Sun or some kind of thing like that, and I'm not interested in doing that. I'm going to be doing some of that for my own homebrew stuff later on down the line. See, a lot of my Paragon and Epic Tier stuff is going to be based on, and this will date me, but a lot of the Myst and Uru stuff from Cyan Worlds video game way back.
yep, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I think you and I are the same age, so.
Yeah, I guess that's probably, I think that's probably true. So, and while those settings never really had what you'd call monsters in them, they will now. And but the mythology about it is with it, and the whole storyline that the Rand brothers has come up with is actually pretty cool. So, but anyway, no, I love Dark Sun and would play it in a second. I'll probably get the source book for some and you know, steal liberally from it in some cases, but I don't think I would run a whole campaign in it, probably.
Yeah, I, you know, I've already said I play in Eberron. I play in Eberron I DM in Eberron for some very specific reasons. First of all, I love, you know, mystery and intrigue. I love having multiple antagonists and kind of keep, you know, the characters make a lot of progress, but they're, you know, they are always guessing until the very last, you know, exactly who's behind what and you know, what forces are at hand. And Eberron is perfect for that. I mean, it is just ripe for mystery and intrigue because everybody is at war with everybody else or has been for almost 100 years. And, you know, then you've got all these unknown continents off to the side, which who knows what's going on over there. So there's just so much to play with.
It's a great campaign, you know, setting.
Yeah, I love it. And I like high magic just in the idea that there's, you know, there's very, very mundane magic everywhere around the players. But at the same time, there's also the very rare stuff that they can get a hold of that makes them kind of set out from the rest. And it also doesn't limit what the players can do with their characters. You know, if they want to be, one guy is a sword mage, kind of arcane detective. And in a setting like Eberron, that's perfect. I mean, that is completely not unheard of. While not something you'll find every day, it's something my players can definitely do. So my characters can come to me wanting to be artificers that are made out of living stone or all sorts of different stuff. And in a place like Eberron, it's just so easy to say yes. It also gives me the ability to create these worlds that I am more into, which is that, you know, our blog carnival that we just did, I already have this world that's kind of set up. There are kind of parameters already set up, and the players, you know, I can point them at Wikipedia and I can point them at texts and give them the Eberron Player's Guide and be like, look, this world is populated already. You know, there are places that you know you should go. There are places you know you shouldn't. There are places that are a little more dangerous than others. It gives me the ability to.
Hello?
Do we lose him?
I thought it was me again, so I like looked at my head, like looking at the laptop. It's like, what, is the connection drop?
No, it looks like we lost him. Let me call him back. It gives him the ability to.
Yeah. Cliffhanger!
Let's see if he answers. Yeah, really. And let's end this episode.
Yeah, that's right.
Stay tuned next week. Let's see if he answers.
Do you think he just went on, kept talking?
And probably he doesn't realize he's been kicked off yet.
That's hilarious.
Or his internet went out.
Come on.
Well, so while he's talking, I'll talk about mine. My homebrew world is a relatively generic in certain ways, but has some special things about it. And one of the things that's really fun for me as a DM is letting the players explore those fun things and sort of learn how. Oh, Thaddeus said his power went out.
No.
Oh man. That
One of the fun things about running the world is that my players get to investigate that, and they have no preconceived notions of what could possibly be going on in the world because it's a homebrew world, and so it has no written other than the little 15. I give them a 15-page sort of primer on the world and the gods and the holidays and the calendar and a map and.
Wow, sounds exactly like what I do.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Yeah, they
one of the continents, and then they, they can go on and they can explore all kinds of stuff about that. There's nothing preconceived about it other than what I've told them. So that's one of the reasons I do homebrew.
See, being in school and working full time, I do not have the time to write a 15-page primer on a world.
Yeah,
This
is the world. I didn't have it when I first started. I just had like a 2-page thing and I drew a little hand map. That was part of my session prep for the first session was, I'll draw this little map of the area they're going in. And I gave them like 2 paragraphs. But since I've been DMing for 3 years, it's up to 15 pages. So when I have a new set of players, I just give them, here's your primer,
Yeah. How far did I actually make it? Because, I'm playing on my laptop, and it took me a while before I realized I was talking into nothing.
Yes. I knew it.
So the sentence ended with you saying it gives you the opportunity to.
Oh man! Then, yeah, I went for a decent amount of time just talking.
That's awesome.
Without repeating myself to myself, I will answer the question on Dark Sun is that I don't see myself playing or DMing a Dark Sun campaign anytime soon. Just because I don't want to shift gears with the campaign I'm in. And playing wise, not that I'm a one trick pony, but I like Avengers. There are a lot of Divine classes I like, and there's a lot of Arcane classes that I really like. And I feel like my 2 favorite power sources in the game have become very difficult to play in Dark Sun. I feel like Dark Sun is kind of the campaign that says, hey, look, not a lot of people play Martial and not a lot of people play Primal, and we want you guys to play these 2. So here's Dark Sun and screw all the other classes. So as a player, I will probably avoid Dark Sun. And I know everybody right now is all stoked about Dark Sun. And so, you guys were saying that, people are going to be bugging out about not liking Forgotten Realms, but I'm not a fan of Dark Sun, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to Dark Sun because I'm interested in the mechanical changes that they're making for some of the things. And I'm sure I'll buy it because I have a horrible completist habit, but I think that, and I may or may not run it. If I run it, it'll be run as sort of a parallel universe. This is I entered that contest on the Tome Show's on the Vorpal Network blog for the Tome Show where he's giving away the Amethyst book,
Yeah.
And I said, well, if I bought it, I would run it, and I would run it as it's written in the book, but I would run it as a parallel universe. So I would tell my players to generate their PCs based on the Amethyst rules, as though they were living in Amethyst universe, but the same characters that they're playing now, as though they were in this other world. Sort of like that Mirror Mirror episode from Star Trek, the original series, right? Where they all go and Spock has a goatee and Captain Kirk is an alien, basically, right? And that's sort of how I would run it. It's a parallel sort of mirror universe. And we might run a short, 6-session campaign or something, but probably not long term. I may do the same thing with Dark Sun, because I think it's interesting to explore the different mechanics.
So you guys, none of you guys have played or run Dark Sun yet?
I've played the older version.
Okay.
Yeah, I've played second edition, and I have the second edition box set.
I played a couple encounters. Okay. That's my total of experience with it.
Yeah, because I ran PAX East. I ran one of the Dark Sun sessions, and then I also ran half of the free RPG day module. And I don't know, I would have a hard time, I think, playing a long-term campaign in it. I don't know, maybe they'll come up with something interesting in the source books. But my players really enjoyed having the change of pace that Dark Sun allowed when we ran it the other week at our table as a off-campaign game.
I really enjoyed the Penny Arcade podcast of the Dark Sun thing that they made. I thought that was really enjoyable. So it got me excited for Dark Sun just to see sort of what, you know, what's WotC throwing at us now? What have they changed that's going to be new and interesting? And I hesitate to say new and better, but I know it'll be new and interesting, so we'll see.
So I have one kind of caveat with Dark Sun is that so the divine power source kind of out the window. Arcane power source is kind of out the window unless you, you know, jump through the loopholes of being one of the there's the some kind of underground freedom front that uses magic, but they're really weak compared to the defilers. I can't remember what they're called, but you know, this is my extent of the knowledge of the Dark Sun lore right here. And so that leaves you. I mean, I don't know about Primal. I don't know about the history of Dark Sun well enough to know, you know, are Primal classes still available in Dark Sun? But really, that pretty much tells me that because 4E is based on the makeup that you have to have specific things in your group to make a – I guess you don't have to have them, but it's better to have them. You know, leaders, you're basically – every party's going to have a warlord, or every party's going to have a lot of heal checks and healing potions because you're not left with a lot.
Yeah, there's psionics too.
A druid or shaman can fill a healing role. So there's your primal right there.
I didn't know if the primal magic still exists or if that's all magic the same. That's, you know, is it just arcane that's illegal, or is a druid going to be, you know, basically
arcane
banned
is
cities or?
It's. My understanding is it's arcane. My understanding is it's arcane and that the primal is fine.
Primal is like, it's like old world religion, right? It's like superstition and sort of naturalistic type stuff. It's the way that they take it, right? So it's not like arcanic magic where it's wielding sort of the bad juju kind of thing.
No, it's more of an animistic type. It's very much based on the elements. You know, they revere the sun, the moon, you know, water, very basic. There's no, at least, and I'm going back, excuse me, I don't have a current, I don't, I'm not sure when's Dark Sun being.
That's sort of what I meant by ritualistic though. I meant like, if you think about what, you know, what sort of, what magic were they doing on Earth, you know, 4,000 years ago? Well, the shaman of whatever tribe was doing, you know, a sort of ritual type, you know, animistic, you know, we're worshipping fire right now because we need it to cook the meat so we can eat.
Right, that's exactly what's going on.
Yeah, that's what I meant by ritualistic, not like the D&D 4E ritual.
Okay.
Now, as far as arcane magic goes, there are two paths. You can go with defilers who can, at least in the old rules, not how they handle it in the new rules. In the old rules, you could raise an experience level much faster with defiler magic. Or you could go with preserver magic, which was more of a traditional route.
My understanding in fourth edition is that the defilers get stronger encounter or dailies. It's just dailies, and that's how they're handling it. But I haven't seen the real books. I've only seen the modules.
I wonder if that's going to be a significant trade-off or not. Because one of the appeals, I mean, it was actually one of the first times in a campaign setting I'd seen a mechanic where, gee, I can trade off raising really fast, because defilers raised like rogues did in second edition. I mean, it was like really quick. And it's like, well, I could do that or and like destroy everything around me, or I could be a preserver and raise, you know, like a mage, often would usually raised in second edition, which was actually one of the slowest classes to level. So yeah, it was a big big trade off there.
See, I don't kind of interesting. I wouldn't see them keeping that kind of mechanic in fourth edition since balance is the seems to be the war cry of fourth edition. So.
And that's understandable. I just, you know, was kind of curious. I thought maybe they might give them an additional encounter power or something, you know.
Yeah, because you have to give a player a reason to want to play a shunned class.
Right.
I mean, there has to be some really good benefit to it. Otherwise, no one will do it. And then you lose a sort of special piece of the world and a special piece of adventuring with a group with that. I mean, you know, it's one of the basic tenets of Dark Sun is that the, you know, arcanic magic is bad to the general population.
Right.
So, you know, if you never have a player that wants to do that then because the benefit isn't big enough, then you're going to lose that whole portion of the world. And I could imagine, I am imagining that would be very bad.
But see, that would be the benefit of being a defiler. If you wanted to be, did you say it was a preserver?
Right.
Is the other type of wizard? So the...
Right.
So if you wanted to be a preserver, you wouldn't get much of a bonus. You would just get shunned.
Yeah, I don't. They didn't make it clear in the beginning part exactly how. Like they hinted at the difference in daily powers, but I didn't see exactly how they were setting it up mechanically. It's possible that they gave you something else, that just maybe. Maybe the attack wasn't as strong and that it didn't deal as much damage, but I'm just guessing at this point.
Yeah. When does the book get released?
I think August. In August.
July. Oh, I thought it was in July. Oh, no, that's the Ravenloft game that's coming out in July, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I
so, think it's so basically at Gen Con then, probably.
Yeah, but I think right after or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
So anybody getting the Ravenloft game?
Never been a huge fan of Ravenloft, so probably not.
Yeah. You know, I got to tell you, my girlfriend is a huge board game geek, and her and I are big supporters of BGG, the BGG website, BoardGameGeek.com, and also RPGGeek.com. But anyway, little plug there. But you know, we have a ton of board games because of that. But you know, it's not her style of game. She doesn't sort of like the fantasy meme and. Theme, so we probably won't get it, sadly, because I hear that it kicks ass. Now I have to put an explicit tag on this. I hear that it kicks quite a considerable butt. And I'm really interested in it, but I probably, to be honest, won't buy it. I would rather spend the money on D&D stuff, which I know I'll use, than a board game that I probably won't.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna get it. Plain and
I don't know, does
simple.
Does it have cool miniatures in it? I might take it and then rip out all of the miniatures if it's got.
They are unpainted miniatures, but it's gonna have something like 46 miniatures. Or let me see if I can find the information about
it. Right there.
But
there's another game coming out as well.
Dungeons of Dragonfire Mountain is also coming out.
Right, and it's gonna be the same way with 40 miniatures or 60 miniatures or something like that.
Oh, cool.
So it could be worth it if you're a board game player as well to buy it for the miniatures. But to be honest, I'm more on the RPG side, and it just doesn't match.
Yeah, it's gonna come with 40 miniatures. It'll come with 13 sheets of interlocking dungeon tiles.
Oh wait, I might have to buy it for that.
that's a good
point. The minis are unpainted, but you know I'm having a good time learning how to paint minis over here anyway. Mm-hmm. And it's from what I've read, it's 40 miniatures from discontinued sets.
Oh wow!
And so both board games are going to have these miniatures, and a couple of them are going to be kind of the larger miniatures. I think they're supposed to be like a dragon lich or something like that in it. But I mean, the board game is. From what I hear, and this is all hearsay and conjecture. Yeah, I'm looking at a picture right now, and there is a large dragon lich in this set. But the conjecture, the rumors I've heard is that these two board games are part of the reason why Wizards of the Coast has cut back their miniature lines for this year, because they actually had to pull something like four sets out of they pulled four out of retirement and put them back into production, which slowed down their productions on their regular miniature line.
Right.
I mean, they are pretty limited in how much they can print as far as minis each year. And when they, you know, they're taking a step into this board game market, and, you know, if it works out for them, great. Then they'll probably have money to fund the board games, and next year everything will be fine. If it takes a nosedive, chances are we won't be seeing minis for a while, because they, you know, they probably blew a large chunk of their budget on it. So,
right. I wish they had just started producing miniatures for role playing purposes and had not tried to make it into a game, because I think they would have been much more successful with a low end cost miniature. I would have much rather been able to buy a half a dozen skeletons for $2.50 than have to spend, you know, which is what I would do if I went aftermarket now.
Right.
It's just...
Yeah, they could do something like, you know, Box of Undead and give you, you know, 10 skeletons and a skeleton cultist or caster or something and a leader character.
And that's...
You know, and do it that way and sell it for the same price as a box of minis now. And,
right.
But, you know, there's no randomness, so you know what you're getting, you know. But, you know, I guess it's a cost-benefit analysis, because I don't know how many people were playing the minis game and who were buying it blind because they needed to get a certain point value army, and how many would keep doing that versus, you know, someone saying, well, I don't need those skeletons, so the mini game player is not going to buy the skeleton box, only the RPG-er.
Right. And that's why I think it should have gone. I mean, even though they included cards, the sets they've released the last couple of years with the clear packaging or whatever, I think those are geared more towards RP, even though they're still nodding their head towards the miniature game.
Yeah.
Well, with the clear package, the cards that they released with it aren't for the mini game anymore. The mini game's been discontinued. It's all RP now.
It's okay, well then that confirms,
it's a 4E stat block on those cards.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah.
And they had been moving towards that for quite some time, because the more recent minis game boxes also had 4th edition stats or probably 3rd edition stats on the back.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went to 4th edition, and they started putting 4th edition stats on the back, but they still had minis game stats on it. And now they're just fully 4th edition stats. They don't even do minis game anymore.
You know, from a business standpoint for the minis, and this is kind of the sad but true part of the game, minis are something that only DMs buy, whereas books, you know, you've got both players and DMs putting some money into books. DMs buying the kind of settings, and the players buying the players' handbooks and the class guides and stuff like that. Minis, you know, only DMs buy them. DMs only need a certain amount of them. And DMs we're outnumbered. Usually players five to one, 6 to 1. I've been trying to find a game where I can play, and I end up DMing everything because there's nobody willing to DM. And so I have to...
You know what proved what you just said? When they released the PHB Heroes line and it didn't sell and they canceled it, because they specifically released it focused on players, because they thought, well, the only mini a player needs is a player's mini. So we're going to try to sell those to the players, and we'll pack them in threes and we'll do whatever. And then they didn't sell because players don't want to buy minis. The DMs buy minis. You're exactly right.
Yeah.
No,
go ahead.
Well, if they're a player, they probably want something a little more geared, individualized towards them than the ones that come in those boxes. At least that's been my problem. Finding an appropriate mini for my characters is often impossible.
Yes.
Yeah, my players...
I am on that same train with you,
My players do the Reaper mini action, or, you know, one even did the Anima RPG. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. I've never played that one, but you know, they all go out and find a figure that matches them, and they'll build it. There's no reason to go.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's no reason to go. Oh, I was just gonna say, yeah, as a player, I would go straight to Reaper and find a miniature that fit me exactly. Yeah. As a DM, I want something cheap though.
Yeah. Yeah.
As a player, there's no reason to go out and buy 3, 4, or a pack of 9 miniatures when you have one character.
Right. Well, particularly when your character lasts so long now.
Yeah. As a DM, there's no reason to go buy 3 heroes when all you need is monsters. And right. So sadly the heroes line was kind of doomed to fail from the beginning.
Right, right. Well, I think that we've had an awesome conversation, and it's going to be very interesting for our listeners, and we should probably wrap it up. So I want to give everybody a chance to give a shout-out to their whatever they want to pimp website or your Twitter feed or whatever. Randall, you have anything you want to pimp on this on the end of this podcast?
No, I'm just building mobs, so check out Initiative of What for the next couple of weeks. I'll be doing mobs and all 3 tiers so that you can have hordes of villagers or guards or cultists or whatever totally hunting down your players and messing them up.
Awesome. And that's initorwhat.com.
Yes, www.initorwhat.blogspot.com.
Awesome. Thaddeus?
Yeah, this week I'm pimping ilovecats.com. It's not my website. I love cats. No, I don't. That's awesome. Yeah. I don't think there really is even a website there. I'm pimping as always.
I'm going to go buy that domain now.
I have really to pimp. I've got, you know, the forthcoming for 3 Geeks 4E podcast that you and I are a part of, and then mydndgame.net, and then my fun t-shirts, which I'm actually wearing one right now. Go buy my shirts, the store's on my website. And that's about it. Randall, don't you have a contest coming up to win a shirt sometime soon?
Yeah, I got to come up with a good contest. So I'm still working on an idea for a contest or two. So don't worry, when I come up with one, I will email you.
Awesome.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tracy, what do you got?
Well, I'm also known as Sarah Dark Magic on Twitter with an H. So you can always find me there. Also, Sarah Dark Magic.
She pimped Twitter. I forgot.
I pimped Twitter. I have to keep my follower list up. You guys are catching up with me. I also have SarahDarkMagic.com, and I am now known as the Player's Guide on TemporaryHitPoints.com.
Oh, wow. Nice. Yeah, you're branching out there.
Trying. Building the brand.
Nope. Yeah, awesome. Well, I am DM Samuel on RPGMusings.com. I recently took on some contributors, so now there are 4 people currently writing for the website. So you don't just get my voice, you get 3 other awesome voices. And so the content is also a little more varied than it used to be. I'm still mostly focused on 4E, but it's branching out a little bit, and it's fun. Thaddeus mentioned the new podcast, 3 Geeks 4E. At Twitter, I am DM Samuel. So I'll pimp that, and I got to keep my follower count up too. And so I'll send out a plea to Monkey King because he unfollowed me today, and I was telling Tracy that I was really sad that he unfollowed me. So follow me again, please, if you listen to this. but enough whining. I hope everybody enjoyed this conversation, and this is the Friends of the. Or Fellowship of the Tweet. I don't even know the name of our group.
We are not Friends of the Trees. Ask
freaking hippies.
We use the hashtag FOTT on Twitter, so that's feel free to follow that because you'll hear about when we're going to record next and what we're doing, and we sometimes talk in character there. And I'm sure that Chaz Standish, Fighting Man, will have lots of things to say.
Absolutely.
So you might want to follow that. But FOTT also stands for Friends of the Trees. And so every once in a while, there's an interesting little post there from them in our feed, having nothing to do with D&D. So In any case, thank you.
Sam, yes. let me interrupt and say let's wish our illustrious DM, newbie DM,
yes,
safe travels to England and thereabouts. So.
Yeah. Yes, newbie DM, safe travels.
I also remembered that I want to pimp Twitter as well, but it's not my Twitter account. The group, four of us and our Fellowship of the Tweets, we actually have a Twitter account, and it's FOTTDND, and we broadcast all of our original Dungeons & Dragons adventures through that account, so you can follow that if you want to keep up to date on what the group's doing when we are playing.
Mm-hmm. Ah, cool. I don't even think I knew about that. That's awesome.
That's because Chaz Standish hadn't joined the group yet when that was created. So.
Oh, I see. That explains it.
So for those of you who don't know, because the audio hasn't been posted, and if you didn't follow us on Twitter before, Randall's last PC was eaten by a ghoul while we were all paralyzed and we watched. And Gar Strongstone went to pack up his goods so he can return them to his family, and Thaddeus's character quickly picked my pocket and took all of his goods away. So it was quite entertaining, old school D&D.
Cleric fail.
Yes, that's cleric right. fail. But, you know, not for lack of trying, I'll say that. I do have one thing I want to pimp. RPG Musings has figured out, I know this is why I started at quarter till saying let's wrap up. Yes. RPGMusings.com has determined what its next contest giveaway is going to be. I don't know what the contest is going to be, but I know what the giveaway is. The giveaway is the new set of D&D Redbox that's coming out.
Nice.
In September. Thanks. So I've already purchased it, and as soon as it's released, it will be mailed to me at my house. But I bought two of them, one to give away and one for myself. So keep your eyes on the website and look for that, and I will expect everyone here that's talking to me right now to also enter that competition.
Now, did you pre-order that, or did you buy it? Is it already in the stores?
No, I pre-ordered. It's not released until late September.
If Randall enters the competition, there's no point in me entering it.
Yeah.
Yeah, really.
Hey, I'm hoping that we win the get-together or don't split the party contest.
Yeah. I am in the middle of writing our entry for the Don't Split the Party contest for Wizards of the Coast. We may all get flown to Gen Con, though. I doubt we will qualify just because we've never actually sat together. But we'll see.
Shh, not as far as they know.
Oh, yeah, unless anyone listens to this. That's okay, though. That's okay. You know what? You never know until you try. So
that's right.
All right, and so let's... Let's say goodbye and sign out. I will turn off the recording in just one second.